a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
House State Affairs Committee will please come to order. Welcome to everyone joining us today, and a reminder that if you intend to testify, we'd appreciate it if you would sign in at the back of the room at the podium there. Also a reminder to make sure your cell phones are on vibrate or shut off altogether. We'd appreciate that. And a welcome also to those of you listening to us live on the internet. I might remind everyone that we are being recorded and will be saved. Any testimony here today will be saved and available to you on the internet forever and ever and ever. We have one page that appears with us today, and if there's any handouts or anything you need distributed, please just let the page know and she will distribute any handouts to us. With that, I would ask the secretary to please call the roll.
Representative Boomgarden.
Here.
Ingalls.
Here.
Feinstein. Gosch.
Here.
Hunhoff.
Here.
Lucas.
Here.
Lust.
Here.
Rausch.
Here.
Rave.
Here.
Steele.
Here.
Turberville.
Here.
Noam.
Here.
Fain.
Here.
Go find Sam again.
Fain.
All present.
Here.
With that, I would look for a motion, entertain a motion to approve the minutes of our previous meeting. Motion by Rave, second by Noam. Any comments? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried. With that, I better get on the right agenda. We will open comment on House Bill 1059 to authorize the State Investment Council to discuss in executive session certain information exempt from public disclosure. Are there any proponents to House Bill 1059? Morning, Mr. Clark.
Morning. Are we on?
Yes, sir.
There's a one-page handout.
May just excuse me, sir, for the record, just identify yourself.
My name is Matt Clark. I'm the state investment officer, and I'm here to advocate for the investment council's desire for this legislation. With me today are four investment council members. We have Wes Cheddar, who's an appointee by the executive board to the investment council, one of the five of their appointees. We also have Treasurer Vern Larson, SDRS Executive Director Rob Wiley, and School and Public Lands Commissioner Jared Johnson, all of whom are on the investment council, and they would all be happy to help answer any questions that you may have. And as the bill's getting handed out, at the top, we simply repeat what it is, a simple sentence that says we may discuss and consider any document or information exempt from public disclosure requirements under provisions of a section of last year's new open records law. That section from last year's open records law is in the indented print immediately below, which talks about financial commercial information, including related legal assistance and advice. Basically, it deals with investment research strategies and confidential information in relation to the investments. Our interpretation of this is that it would apply to confidential information that we get from outside parties or in-house research is confidential, and the council does not have any desire to make public, and thus, without a law like this, the council is unable to discuss that type of information in open session, and therefore it cannot discuss it in a meeting. And if the council cannot discuss this type of information, its ability to do its job is impeded. Otherwise, communications have to be done in written form from me to the council, or they have to communicate one-on-one to the council chair. And they cannot even have a chain of email discussion about an issue, or it would effectively comprise a meeting. So key for us for this information and why it's needed is that if we discuss something that's confidential in a meeting, then the confidentiality has been breached, even if no one is there. And then we're subjected to FOIA requests by out-of-state media for that information. And so the council understands the importance of wanting to have open public access and access to our South Dakota media to the maximum extent possible, and we would have that strictest interpretation with the application of this. And that's really the remarks that I plan to make, unless there were any questions.
Thank you, sir. We'll come to questions here in a bit, and we'll probably call you back. Thank you. Any other proponents to House Bill 1059? Any further proponent testimony to House Bill 1059? Seeing none, is there any opponent testimony? Any opponent testimony to House Bill 1059? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony and open to any questions from the committee. Are there any questions? Must have done a good job. Seeing none, we'll close committee questions, move into committee comments and or action. Are there any comments? Representative Rave.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move to pass.
Motion by Rave.
Seconded.
By a lot of people. any further comments or Representative Rave?
I just think that, thank Mr. Clark for coming up today and explaining this. It seems fairly straightforward and appears to be just some cleanup from what we passed last year to make sure that to allow them to discuss this information. I would just ask for your favorable support.
Any further comments? Seeing none, we have a do pass motion for House Bill 1059. All in favor of the motion will say aye. All opposed will say no. The secretary will please call the roll.
Representative Boomgarden?
Aye.
Ingalls?
Aye.
Feinstein?
Aye.
Gosh?
Aye.
Hunhoff?
Aye.
Lucas?
Aye.
Lust?
Aye.
Rausch?
Aye.
Rave?
Aye.
Steele?
Aye.
Turberville?
Aye.
Noem?
Aye.
Fain?
Aye.
13 ayes.
13 ayes and zero noes. With that, House Bill 1059 is nothing. Waiting just in case. House Bill 1059 will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. With that, we'll take up public testimony on House Bill 1011 to revise certain provisions related to high performance green building standards. Are there any proponents to House Bill 1011? Good morning. I don't believe your mic's on, man.
Sorry.
That's no problem.
My name is Christy Honeywell. I'm the state engineer in the Bureau of Administration. Good morning again to you. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 1011. As many of you know, 2 years ago in the 2008 legislature, a bill was passed to require all new construction and major renovations of state-owned buildings be constructed to a high-performance green building standard. There were three different rating systems that could be used to meet that standard. One of them was LEED, developed by the U.S. Green Building Council. Last year, USGBC rolled out a new updated version of LEED, and what House Bill 1011 does is simply allow, it updates the existing statute to allow the Bureau of Administration to use this version of the rating system. And with that, I would respectfully ask your support in passing this out of committee. And I'll be available for questions.
Thank you, ma'am. Are there any further proponents? Any further proponents to House Bill 1011? Seeing none, are there any opponents? Any opponents to House Bill 1011? Seeing none, we'll open to committee questions. Are there any questions from the committee? Seeing none, we'll move to committee comment and or action. Representative Gosh. Whole bunch of you guys down there.
I move to pass House Bill 1011.
Motion by Gosh, second by Rave. Further comments, Representative Gosh?
Well, as explained by the proponent testimony, this is just a perfunctory change, and and it sounds like it's necessary, so I would urge your support. Thank you.
Further comments? Seeing none, we have a do-pass motion for House Bill 1011. All in favor will say aye. All opposed will say no. The Secretary will please call the roll.
Representative Boomgarten?
Aye.
Ingalls?
Aye.
Feinstein?
Aye.
Gosch?
Aye.
Hunhoff?
Aye.
Lucas?
Aye.
Lust?
Aye.
Rausch?
Aye.
Rave?
Aye.
Steele?
Aye.
Turberville?
Aye.
Noem?
Aye.
Faint?
Aye.
13 ayes, no nays, zero nays.
House Bill 1011 has passed committee unanimously. Representative Rave?
I move consent.
Motion by Rave, second by Gosch. Consent. Any objections? Hearing none, House Bill 1011 will go to the House floor on the with a do-pass motion on the consent calendar. One housekeeping matter, House Bill 1059, I didn't hear a consent motion on that. Representative Lucas, would you carry 1059 to the floor? Thank you. House Bill 1061, to revise certain provisions regarding organization and operation of the public entity pool for liability. Are there any proponents for House Bill 1061? Good morning, Mr. Fulton.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Neil Fulton, Office of the Governor. 1061 deals with what's commonly known as the People Fund, the Public Entity Pool for Liability. And we have two goals with 1061. The first is to repeal a considerable amount of what is now antiquated language and reflect the reality of the operation of the People Fund. The second is to avoid misinterpretation of the operation and intent of the People Fund. And I want to take those up one at a time, but first give a little bit of background. The People Fund was created by the legislature in 1986. The original intent was to allow all public entities to participate in the People Fund by pooling funds to provide liability coverage for government entities and employees. As it was originally framed, it would allow people to join as members, including the state, municipalities, counties, and other sub-entities of government. As it turned out, we didn't have participation by counties and local entities of government. In 1991, in Chapter 124, was created that allowed pooling. Essentially, they can come together in the same mechanism that was originally intended by the People Fund to pool their resources and provide liability coverage. Chapter 124 also allows the local entities of government to provide coverage for health, workers' comp, and property insurance. I really honestly don't know historically why the counties and local entities went their separate way, but they did. Currently, we have the People Fund that's operated by the state and provides coverage for state entities and employees, and we have what's called the South Dakota Public Assurance Alliance, which provides coverage for local entities from municipalities, counties on down to local entities of government. That's the lay of the land today, which leads to the first major thrust of what we're doing in 1061. Much of 1061 that you see overstricken provides for operation in terms of becoming a member, making contributions, setting amounts of contribution, and those things. Because the counties and local entities of government aren't participating, and frankly at this point have no intention to participate, we've overstricken that. The only entity that's going to be a part of the People Fund is the state, its entities, and its employees. So we want to take those things out. The second thing we want to do is move to what is the current structure of the People Fund. If you look at what was Section 1, there was an enumeration of certain causes of action that would or would not be covered under the People Fund. In reality, what we have today is a situation that although the People Fund is not insurance, it operates effectively like insurance. We have a director who forms a contract under a coverage document with the governor. It provides the terms, the scope, and the conditions of coverage, sets out what causes of action are covered, which ones are not. It bears a strong resemblance to your traditional liability policy that you would carry. The things that are excluded, criminal acts, certain asbestos, those types of things. And then we have exclusions up to the fullest scope of our sovereign immunity under state law. As many of you know, under Article 3, Section 27 of the Constitution, the state retains sovereign immunity except to the scope that the legislature waives it. Our amendments would simply provide that the scope is the scope of the coverage document, which is current case law. If you want to look at a case called Brown Eyes versus DSS and some others, the Supreme Court has consistently interpreted the scope of sovereign immunity that's retained to be the scope of the coverage document. So we've changed a little bit from enumerating which causes of action are in and out in the statute to simply providing that that will be in the coverage document. The last thing we do is the last section of the bill, which I included. It has a savings clause that simply says nothing in this act affects any operation of a pooling arrangement under 124. That would be the city and county pool. Again, the South Dakota Public Assurance Alliance, they're doing what they're doing. I don't think that necessarily needs to be included, but it seemed prudent to just put that in so everyone knew that we didn't want to affect those folks. Last thing I guess we do is I think the bill leaves the scope of sovereign immunity where it is today, statutory immunities and other defenses that would be available to state employees in a particular lawsuit in place. Second major thing we do is try and avoid misinterpretation, in particular as it relates to the South Dakota Public Assurance Alliance, again, the city and county pool, and this points up the need to sort of sweep them out of the chapter. There was a coverage dispute arising from a case in Pennington County. And in that case, the judge interpreted these statutes, Chapter 322, which the city and county pool is not organized under, as applicable, which is a problem. And so we want to move them out. And the second thing he did is read existing Section 1, which says that it shall be the sole source of payment to require payment of a claim. In other words, the judge interpreted it to say, because a claim was brought, you had to pay it. Well, that's a good recipe for the pools to go broke quickly. So if you look at what we've done in Section 1, we've simply provided that you'll provide liability and defense coverage as provided in the coverage document. And then we specifically enumerated that the chapter doesn't require payment of any particular claim or class of claims. It is ultimately just like an insurance policy. If someone feels like they've been injured by a state entity or a state employee, they can bring a claim. Many of those are disposed of by negotiated settlement before a lawsuit is filed or after a lawsuit is filed. Some of them go to trial. The state wins some. The state loses some. They operate just like any other liability setting. So that's the purpose of the bill, and that's sort of how we've tried to do it. And I think rather than go section by section, it would be easiest just to stand by for any questions that the committee might have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Further proponent testimony. Any further proponents for House Bill 1061? Are there any opponents? Any opponent testimony for House Bill 1061? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony and open to committee questions. Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Engels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Questions for Mr. Fulton. How often is the coverage document changed?
Mr. Chairman, it's done annually, Representative Engels. In terms of actual changes, fairly infrequently. One of the last ones that I can remember was during the time frame of the GINA score lawsuits, there was a change made to our exclusion for criminal and intentional acts. Candidly, Governor Janklow took a very aggressive reading of that in that case, and we modified it. My law firm, Brent Wilburn, Rob Anderson, I worked on modifying it to more accurately reflect what you'd find in a typical commercial policy for excluding criminal intentional acts. It can be updated every year, but that's the last specific one I can remember.
These proposed changes, is the effect of those changes going to be that the governor and the People Fund director who's appointed by the governor will have more authority than what they have now? If we're taking things out of law and just handing it over to them, is that right?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think so, because ultimately right now in the coverage document, they can set the scope of coverage. What I think the statute does right now is align the outer boundaries of coverage with the current parameters of sovereign immunity under state law. I mean, if you look at the current act, it talks about civil rights claims arising under federal law under 42 U.S.C. Section 1983, talks about car accidents, those types of things, and that's what the coverage document reflects. I think there is an outer boundary in any effort we would make to narrow the coverage document that's been reflected in the South Dakota Supreme Court's consistent limiting of attempts to use the coverage document to narrow the class of claims that are covered. In particular, there is a statute still on the books that says that sovereign immunity applies to both discretionary and ministerial acts done by state employees. A ministerial act is something that's dictated as to the time, place, and manner of performance. Driving a car is the classic example. A discretionary act is more a policy setting action. If the director or, excuse me, Secretary of Game, Fish, and Parks sets a policy and someone alleges that that policy decision leads to their injury, he retains sovereign immunity for that. In a series of cases going back to one called Kylo versus Panzer, the Supreme Court said that the open courts clause of the South Dakota Constitution won't let you move those boundaries of sovereign immunity. So I think ultimately we're constrained by those boundaries, and those are the main ones. And I think we're still constrained by that, so it doesn't give them more power than we have today. That was a really long-winded answer and probably confused you more than anything. Sorry about that.
Further questions, Representative Lust.
Thank you. Mr. Fulton, I have a question for you on page 10. There's a specific reference to having to consult the Attorney General's office before entering into a negotiated settlement. Customarily, isn't there a separate attorney representing the People Fund? And why would you not rely on simply that attorney's experience and expertise?
Mr. Chairman, well, Representative Lust, he's new and we wanted to make him feel good. In actuality, yeah, there is typically a retained attorney that represents these separate from the Attorney General's office. The reason that we left that in there is it has been in there in the past and frankly has worked pretty well. What we've had in terms of an arrangement is this applies only to negotiated settlements in practice. What they've done in the past is negotiated settlements that are reached prior to the retention of counsel. There are a certain number that the director and his staff handle, and so they consult them. And even when we've retained counsel, we consult the Attorney General's office simply because a second set of eyes is good, and you know he is the state's lawyer, and we feel it's important to keep him involved in that process. As a matter of practice, I know Attorney General Long, and I don't know what Marty's done yet, had, like a lot of insurance companies, do a threshold. I think it was around $10,000 to $20,000. Your typical simple fender bender deal, he gave discretion to the director. Anything over that required consultation. But it's to have a second set of eyes primarily.
Very good. Thank you.
Representative Noem.
Thank you. I just had a question. I see that we're changing some of the authority of the director. We're going from decision making, especially in that same page, section 9, sole authority going to the director instead of the bureau, which had it before. And I was curious as to why that change was made throughout the bill.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Noem, primarily because that just reflects reality. The directors hired by the commissioner of BOA answers to them as a matter of practicality, although the bill would say it's in their sole discretion. I think this would be an instance where it's in their sole discretion but subject to their continued employment. So as an ongoing practical matter, the director handles this day-to-day and BOA doesn't have as much direct oversight.
Further questions? Seeing none, we'll close committee questions and open to any committee comment and or action. Any comments? Representative Lust. Oh, I thought you raised your hand.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Noem.
Mr. Chair, I would move do pass.
Second.
Motion by Noem, second by Rave. Further comments, Representative Noem.
Nothing mind-blowing this morning. Just think that it's good to see some changes. I do recognize that these would be necessary, and I'm glad that we are streamlining. It looks like we're getting rid of a lot of statute here, so I appreciate that.
Further comments? Representative Ingalls.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this is a complicated area of law, and these are very sweeping changes to it. And I remain a little bit concerned about the potential that we're transferring authority here from the legislature and delegating it to the governor and his appointed People Fund director. So I'm going to take a cautious approach, and I'm not going to support this bill at this time.
Further comments? Seeing none, motion on the floor is do pass. Motion, I should say, before the committee is do pass on House Bill 1061. All in favor will say aye. All opposed will say no. The secretary will please call the roll.
Representative Boomgarden?
Aye.
Ingalls?
No.
Kleinstein?
No.
Gosch?
Aye.
Hunhoff?
Aye.
Lucas?
No.
Lust?
Aye.
Roush?
Aye.
Rave?
Aye.
Steele?
Aye.
Turberville?
Aye.
Nome?
Aye.
Fain?
Aye.
10 ayes, 3 nays.
House Bill 1061 will go to the House floor with the due pass recommendation. Representative Lust, would you carry that on the House floor, please? Thank you. Any further business to come before the committee? Seeing none, I'd entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved. Second,
all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. We are adjourned.